Fiddle-dee-diddle-dee-dee-dee-dee. Fiddle-dee-diddle-dee-doo.
When all is ready, I throw this switch.
And we're back. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I am Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, again, Brian Reese.
Hey, here I am.
Hey. So, longtime listeners might have noticed that we've been gone a little while. I did put out a previous episode to explain a little bit why we were taking an impromptu hiatus, but now we're back,
Yes.
and all is well.
We needed some time. Well, so it was me, but yeah.
No, it was us. It was us together. It was a collected effort. Collected edition, you might say.
The collected edition effort. So yeah, sometimes personal life takes some strange and funny turns, and we have to step back for a little bit and deal with those. But yeah, so I've been reading comics the whole time, so we've got months of comics to talk about.
Yes, we do. And a lot of history. So as a recap, a bunch of shit happened and now we're here. No, a lot of there's been a lot of issues and twists and turns in the comic book publishing industry.
I mean, things have been crazy. It's we would have had a lot of topics to talk about. There are some topics I don't want to talk about, one in particular, but
Yes.
as we wait to see the fallout from certain things here, but there's fun things going on too.
Yes. In fact, I think 2024 will be remembered as people waiting to see what the fallout of things are.
Yes, well, yes.
Yes.
In so many ways.
Today on the program, we will be discussing Howard the Duck, specifically the presidential run of Howard the Duck from 1976, written by Steve Gerber and art by Gene Colan. I thought it was going to be very topical since 2024 and 76 are both presidential years, but it might have been a little bit too close to home.
It might have been. Should we tell them what day we're recording this?
So yeah, so we are, I guess I was going to say trigger warning, but probably. Well, okay. So currently, the day we are recording this is July 14th, 2024. And yesterday, someone took a shot at Donald Trump, which is an awful thing to have happen, regardless of your political persuasion. But in this comic we'll be reading today, that happens kind of often. So it's an interesting, I don't know, coincidence that.
Yes, we plan this long in advance. What is the synchronicity?
Synergy.
Synergy. That's the
Yeah,
word
there
we're
you go.
looking for. Synergy.
Yes, corporate synergy is what we have going on here. Wow. So anyway, just so you know, this comic is going to bring up some gun violence in a humorous way, but still, if that bothers you, maybe skip this one. Anyway, everything's really weird these days, man.
Yeah, it's a strange world we live. May you live in interesting times.
Oh, screw that. I want to be bored. I want to be bored and weird and read weird
Not men
comics.
as a blessing, men as a curse.
Yes, indeed. So we decided that since it's about halfway through the year and we haven't really been talking much about stuff, that we would talk about maybe our top five current running comics that we're excited about. So would you like to begin?
Are we going to do one at a time or just kind of list off? I don't really need to like go into a deep discussion on.
No, we're not gonna, it doesn't have to be a deep dive, but just there are things like, okay, I'll start.
All right.
All right. I debated on this one, but I'm really excited about it. It's only been one issue, but Doom from Marvel, about Dr. Doom by Jonathan Hickman and Stanford Green. It's only been one issue. It's a little oversized issue, and it's about Dr. Doom fighting Galactus. And it's really interesting. It's very John Hickman-y. It's Hickman-esque. And the art is beautiful, and I'm really excited to see where this is going to go. Don't know if you've read that one issue yet.
I have not.
Okay. Well, I just am again, one issue. I highly recommend it. It's really, the art alone is just brilliant. So it's Stanford Green doing the art and the coloring, and it's just a stunning thing to look at. Even if it was just that one issue, it's really cool. What are you excited about, sir?
Well, gosh. So I'll just start with something that ended, but it was through this year. And this will probably show up again. And if anybody follows us regularly, this will be a no-brainer. Rare Flavors.
Oh, yeah.
From the same creative team as Layla Starr. Ron V is like, I don't necessarily love his detective run. I think he's trying to do something interesting. I don't know if it works. But generally, Ron V could do no wrong. And Rare Flavors, again, from the same creative team, was just, and this was about food, and it's about Indian food. And I just salivated, I think, through the whole. I took note that, like, there are recipes in the comic, but it's also about life and how one approaches life and about appetite. And it's about God. And it's about so many things. Rare Flavors just, it's over. It was fantastic, which I knew it would be. So I came in biased, but.
Yep. Another stellar run from that creative team. And, you know, using food as a metaphor for savoring life. They need to do more and more and more.
Yes.
Because they've knocked two titles out of the park now. My next one, you're going to be really surprised by this one. Mm-hmm. Universal Monsters, The Creature from the Black Lagoon Lives.
I'm shocked.
I know. This, of course, Dan Waters and Rom V. The art by Matthew Roberts and Dave Stewart. It's just fun. Oh, my God. I mean, I love those Universal Monster movies, as I've talked about, because Dracula was great. And this one is similarly as good. New twist on that old story. It's not retelling the movie the way that the Dracula run did, but taking that movie and kind of doing a soft sequel to it.
Oh. Yeah. I should investigate that. I like the Dracula one, but I was like, oh, this is just the Dracula story.
Yeah, so it's doing a sequel to it, and it has a, okay. It's just, I love this. And then, you know, later this year, there's going to be Frankenstein, and it's just, they're making comics for me, Brian. I love it. So anyway, check that out, guys. It's good. What else you got?
I guess the next thing, I'm going to fold two things together because it's the same writer, Rick Remender, who just, like Ron V, has just had stellar comics. So both Grommets and Sacrificers have been comics that I have, and they're so different. They're completely, this is what's great about Rick Remender is, like, he does these projects and they're all over the place, not all over the place in a bad way, but the man is so creative and so interesting. And Grommets is, he's writing with Brian Posehn, who I'm sure many of our listeners are very familiar with. But, you know, it's about 80s skateboarders. And it's hilarious, fun. Sacrificers is much more serious. It's really kind of it's a mythical world, and it's a talking again. I'm going back to gods and monsters and things like that. But it's two different, very vastly different comics from the same writer that have just really captured my attention. So yeah, Grommets and Sacrificers. I'm just going to collapse together into one thing.
Awesome. So. The next thing I was really excited about is, and it just ended, it's a 3-issue mini, The Batman First Night.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's Dan Jurgens and Mike Perkins for the Black Label kind of out of continuity thing. And it's just, I love this take on Batman. It's set in the 30s and it has sort of like a noir feel to it. Again, fantastic art. And, you know, Batman's a detective. It's an interesting take. On the character.
Yeah, Batman is a detective. It's that's crazy talk.
I know. And yeah, it's got that old style. Looks like the, you know, Batman with the big ears and, you know, has sort of this sepia tone tint to it. So anyway, I've been really enjoying that. I'm going to say something, Brian. I think Batman's not my favorite character. I just...
That's okay. It's okay for Batman not to be your favorite character. There are many people out there for whom Batman is not their favorite character.
Yeah. And I just like different, when Batman is done differently is when I get excited about the character. Like this First Night, I think Rom V's Detective Comics run is really great because he's trying to do something experimental and different with it.
Right.
But there you go.
Okay. So next on my list is, we'll like collapse two other ones in so I can keep this down to like five. On the DC side, Hellblazer, Dead in America, Spurrier just gets Hellblazer.
Oh yeah,
and it's so perfectly attuned to like the classic. It's a British writer, which should maybe always be the case with Hellblazer. But man, he just gets John Constantine. Bringing John Constantine back into the United States and having him do a road trip, and there's even Route 66 references. I mean, there's all kinds of it. Just really. this cat should just write Hellblazer from now on until they find someone else similar. But and along with that, on the DC side, Outsiders has been a gloriously meta take on the DC universe, and it got canceled issue 11, of course, because anything that is too smart can't last. But it's if you are a fan of Planetary or Stormwatch or any of that type of stuff, the Outsiders, which is nothing like the previous Outsiders, has been a glorious trip through the bleed and into the secret hidden world of the DC universe. And the fact that they have given Ginny Hex some additional importance in the DC universe makes me very happy. So I think that The Outsiders has been a very under-the-radar great comic that maybe down the line folks will go back and take a look at. It would be nice if it was setting the stage for something that's not absolute. Did I say that out loud? But yeah, no, Outsiders has been, if you're into the history, the secret history of the DC universe, Outsiders is great. Brilliant.
Okay. Okay. The John Constantine is on my list as well. However, I was going to leave it to you to choose that one because I knew it was going to be on yours. And you just recommended Outsiders to me like maybe a week or so ago.
Right.
Which it's on my list to check out because you were so enthusiastic about it like you were just then. So I'm going to be checking that out soon. My next one is a recommendation with a caveat. And it's the crossover from Marvel that's currently running, Blood Hunt.
Huh.
Yeah. I've been enjoying it as far as the main storyline. But there are as with all Marvel crossovers, there's going to be like 50 issues combined with all the different, you know, with all the different spinoffs and so many different tie-ins. But the main story is going to be 5 issues or 6 issues. And that's written by Jed McKay and Pepe Larraz on art. And it's just a fun vampire story. It's like vampire zombies attacking the Avengers. And it's fun. And by fun, I mean, it's horrific. They've been doing Red Label editions with more graphic panels, which is what I've been reading. So I really enjoy that. But I've been trying to read all the supplemental stuff. And I don't know how this works with you when you're reading crossovers. Just some of the other titles just seem like there's no reason for them. They're just sort of running in place.
It's a lot of that is, and it frustrates me because it's leaking into the Marvel titles that I read
right
regularly. Yeah. And you're a vampire monster guy. I'm not. And so for me, it's like with Blood Hunt, it was like, oh, it's vampires again, which is fine. And because, again, people are excited about that and enjoy that. But, you know, when I'm trying to read Doctor Strange and I don't know what's going on.
I was curious about that because I am reading it and I have read the Doctor Strange issues and it fits perfectly well. But yeah, it's just interesting. Like there's a bunch of crossovers with Dracula and Werewolf by Night and Blade, and that all makes perfect sense.
Right.
But you don't need Jubilee and Wolverine and all, they have all these X-Men titles and it's just like, you don't.
You know, and Avengers, stop. Fantastic yeah. Four, Doctor Strange, you know, it's all.
Spider-Man is in there too.
Yeah.
I mean, technically this started in the Spider-Man titles, sort of. I don't know. Crossovers are a weird thing. I just wish they would do the main line and have that be the event. But all the different tie-ins just get to be too much. So anyway,
DC is guilty of the same thing.
Exactly. So my recommendation is read the main storyline of Blood Hunt if you're into the whole horror comic, because it's basically the Avengers fighting vampires. And that's cool.
It is.
But you can probably not read all the sundry things around it. Because it's been running for a while now. And I'm like, oh, I'm just so tired. Can we just, I just want to read the main one. But I feel like, I don't know. It's me, the completist. I feel like I'm going to miss something. And every time I read a spinoff or a tie-in, I'm like, I didn't miss anything.
Nope. Okay.
Anyway, but this is actually the first time I've been interested in a Marvel crossover in quite a while. There you go. What else you got?
Let's see, two more. So the next one is Uncanny Valley.
Oh, yeah.
Tony Fleeks from Stray Dogs. It's just a mini. I think there's only a couple issues left, but it's such an obvious conceit in comics in some ways. It's like, what if cartoon characters were interacting in real life with regular people? But it's done in Tony Fleeks is this cat's this cat's got a future in comics.
He's on Fleek.
Yes. But it's, wow, it's just fun. And again, it's, I guess I like meta stuff clearly because I keep referring, but it's, there's some meta going on there, but it's the way they utilize the different art and the different way that the cartoon universe and the real world interact. It's not a serious comic, but it's a lot of fun. So it's a, that's one I've been really enjoying.
So this one I'm still up in the air about, but been good so far. And it's the new Dick Tracy run out of Mad Cave, which I don't know a lot about Mad Cave publishing, but they're doing a Dick Tracy kind of a reboot, reimagining of him as sort of a hard-boiled noir detective. Okay. And it's been really interesting so far. Michael Moreci, I'm probably mispronouncing his name, Moreci and Alex Segura. I've never been a huge Dick Tracy fan, you know? That's one of those characters that's always there.
Right.
You know, everyone knows who Dick Tracy is. I've never found it very interesting in the past, personally. But this one was, the art was interesting enough for me to say, I want to check this out. So anyway, it's just sort of a hard-boiled detective story with weird gadgets and strange villains with deformities.
Dick Tracy probably has the best rogues gallery.
It's definitely an interesting one. And it's definitely so, you know, so the whole premise is he's new to town. And he's just getting his business set up and he's learning and he's just meeting all the villains. So it is literally a reboot of the whole thing. So anyway, it's interesting. We'll see how it goes. I'm still of two minds about that one. It's like, I don't know where this is going to go, but it's interesting so far. Do you have anything else?
I've got one more, although it's a before I do the next one, I should mention that there is a Space Ghost comic that's out. I don't know if it's great, but it's Space Ghost. And so I'm happy that that exists in the world. But the other one I'm going to go with Boom's Under Heist.
Under Heist? I'm not familiar with this one.
It's David Laugham of Stray Bullets.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Which, dadgummit, can we ever get Stray Bullets finished? Again, it's typical of David Laugham. It's crime, noir, slightly confusing, incredibly unlikable people doing unlikable things, and brilliantly written. Great. So I there's a little bit of a curveball, but I'm always happy when he returns to comics. And so there's only four issues so far. So, but it's crime.
So that's kind of been
a black theme. And white crime.
Yeah, kind of a theme because I have two crime noir choices as well. Last thing really quick. And then we can be done with this, is The Cull from Image. And it's Kelly Thompson. Being Kelly Thompson.
She's doing great work.
Yeah. And it's just about kids. I don't want to give too much away on it. The series just ended. But it's really good. Again, art by Mattia, I'm going to pronounce his name wrong, D'Eloise. Let's go with that.
Sure.
Anyway, I should prepare. You know, we've had enough time. I could have looked stuff up, but I chose not to because it's the spontaneity that people look forward to.
Well, then, and we give them plenty of that.
Exactly. Anyway, check out The Cull, horror sci-fi kind of a thing. And it's Kelly Thompson, which, I mean, come on. If you don't like Kelly Thompson, I don't know who you are. I don't know what you're all about. But there's so many more. There's by the way, Hate has come back. We could just say that as like America in general. Hate has come back.
The comic book. I've missed my misogynist, or not misogynistic, my misanthropic creators. So yeah, always good to see hate returning.
Yeah. And go back and listen to one of our previous issues where we talk about the original run of Hate. Don't know, it's only been one issue.
We'll see. God knows when the next one will drop.
Right. We'll see so far. And I guess final thing, Department of Truth is back. Hooray, finally.
And that Texas Blood and Black Cloak, Kelly Thompson, are scheduled to be returning as well, so which is very exciting. And Public Domain.
And Public Domain is back. So that's it. That was a good chat.
You know, yeah. I mean, yeah. Like you said, we could throw in a bunch more. I mean, but these are kind of newish ones as opposed to, say, Wonder Woman, which is great, you know. Or
yeah, there's a bunch of ongoings that I wanted to just focus on 2024. In general, yeah. but it's shaping up to be a good year for new comics.
Yeah, there's some good stuff in the pipeline looking like as well. So we'll see how they read out.
We will. We'll see how the year shakes out.
Oh, and I should mention just one last quick thing. Gail Simone is writing Superman right now, and that's awesome.
Absolutely fantastic.
One issue again, so not much to talk about, but Gail Simone on Superman is a lovely thing.
And again, just in general, Mark Waid really knows how to write a retro comic, and just been enjoying a lot of things from Mark Waid recently these days. Excellent. Gail Simone and Mark Waid, old school comics, old comic creators, still, you know, knocking it out of the park. I guess that's it. So let's take a break.
Okay.
And when we come back, we will talk about a very bizarre comic from the 70s.
A Duck Named Howard.
That's right.
And we're back. Paul, we are going to be discussing your recommendation today, and your recommendation is Howard the Duck. Would you like to tell us a little bit about your selection today?
I like the dramatic pauses. I have a very vivid memory of being a child sitting on my living room floor with the TV on and reading a stack of comics. This would be the 1970s equivalent of binging a show while scrolling on your phone. And I remember my mother coming into the room to check on me and randomly picking up a comic from my pile, idly thumbing through it. This particular comic featured a duck bursting through a newspaper on its cover. And after reading a few panels, my mother made a disappointed tisk-tisk noise and said, "Honestly, should you be reading this?" This apparently was a rhetorical question because she put the comic back down and I did in fact read it. I remember at the time thinking that particular comic was funny, hilarious in fact, but I admit that it wasn't until years later when I reread it as an adult that I understood the political satire and sexual innuendo that flew over my head as a child and was probably the thing my mother took issue with. You see, Marvel in the 1970s was by many accounts an undisciplined place. The word madhouse is often used to describe it, typically accompanied by the phrase, lunatics running the asylum. There was very little editorial oversight, and creators were given free rein to indulge their passions, as it were. This led to inconsistent quality at times, an abundance of missed deadlines, and notoriously low sales. But despite this chaos, it can be argued that this was one of the most creative and experimental times in Marvel's history. And so many ideas were being thrown at the wall, it began to resemble a Jackson Pollock painting. And nothing exemplifies this creative chaos more than that time Howard the Duck ran for president. Howard was created by Steve Gerber as a one-off gag in a Man-Thing comic. But the character became so popular with fans, it was decided, for some strange reason, to give Howard his own book, where Gerber could indulge his passions, as it were. These passions included political and social satire and parodies of pop culture, current and past, all within the main continuity of Marvel, centering around an anthropomorphic duck that smoked cigars and was horny as hell. Again, Marvel was an undisciplined place. In issues 6 through 9 of Howard the Duck, Gerber and artist Gene Colan have the titular duck recruited by the All-Night Party as their candidate for president in the 1976 election against Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford. It starts simply enough. Howard and his human companion, Beverly Switzler, are hitchhiking through Pennsylvania, and after an encounter with Reverend June Moon Yuck and the incredible cookie creature, they are picked up by Dreyfus Gulch, a rhinestone cowboy scheduled to sing the national anthem at the All-Night Party convention. There, Howard thwarts a bombing attempt and is made the candidate because of his bravery. But from here on, it's simply a vehicle for Steve Gerber to talk about politics, religion, the news media, corruption, and the illusion that we have a say in our electoral system. You know, all the things kids are looking for when they read comics. These issues did make a bit of a splash in the zeitgeist at the time, with campaign pins and t-shirts being sold and rumors that Howard got thousands of write-in votes in the actual election. Although this is no doubt exaggerated or outright made up for promotion. Stan Lee gonna Stan Lee, after all. But regardless, these issues and the entirety of Gerber's run on Howard the Duck is a fascinating glimpse into a particular time in Marvel's history, and a tour de force of a unique and uncommon voice in comics. Not everything still holds up, and maybe the context of some of the jokes are lost, but a surprising amount of the satire is still relevant today, and maybe more so in some cases. So, to answer my mother's question from so many years ago, should I have been reading this comic? Probably not. But I'm glad I did. Brian, what'd you think of Howard the Duck?
Well, I'm really glad we finally got to Howard the Duck, because Howard the Duck, what am I, in New York?
Well, I always picture Howard with a New York, like a Brooklyn accent.
And I just kind of view him more as Bronx-ish, but so we've been dancing around this for a while. I think I have threatened a few times to recommend Howard the Duck because I got tired of waiting for you to do it, knowing he was one of your faves and yes. Steve Gerber being one of your faves. So this is a great comic to like return to podcasting with because it's both funny and serious and has history. We're not doing this isn't a recent comic where we're doing a real honest to goodness dive into comic history. I was very pleased that you selected this, and I was not disappointed. It's been so long, and you know, it's like, what is it, Doctor? The arcs I remember the most that I think I read, like back in the 70s, early 80s, was the Doctor. Was it Dr. Bong? What is it? Or
yes.
Yeah.
Dr. Bong with the bell head.
And I remember being kind of both, like as a kid, I was disturbed more than amused by that. So I was aware a little bit that this had happened. I was too young for it to really matter to me in some ways. But I think as I got older and was more familiar with Howard the Duck, I kind of like fell onto the idea that there was this whole political campaign around him. But I didn't read these in 1976. I was four. No, it's such a fascinating... We often talk about the writer being removed from the work and the ideas of that. And I don't think that you can remove Steve Gerber from Howard the Duck. I think Steve Gerber is Howard the Duck in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think Howard the Duck was a way for him to, like I said, he was just a vehicle for him to, here are my ideas, here are my beliefs, and I can do it in a satirical, you know, tongue-in-cheek kind of way.
Because Steve Gerber was a fascinating guy.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you know, he is, you know, it's no secret. He is one of my favorite writers in comics history. I think he's, like you said, just a fascinating guy, really interesting ideas, really had a very different approach to creating comics than a lot of people did then and do today.
Right.
Yeah. And he started as an advertising guy. That's why he hates Madison Avenue so much in these comics, but he started as a different kind of writer and then moved into comics. And I don't know. I think he had a lot of previous experience in the corporate world that comes out pretty strongly.
But also, I mean, the humor and like another reason why I view this as a very Paul comic is I could not in any way, shape or form keep track of all the dad jokes.
Lots of dad jokes, lots of references, lots. So full disclosure, we're not going to go through every single joke in this. I think we'll just go in an overall kind of synopsis of everything. Yeah, there's I highly suggest, just say this now, spoiler, I like this comic. You should go and read it. I think there's enough in here that you're probably going to be laughing in pretty much in every panel. Plus, he does things that, you know, Gerber was very much into the, you know, classic horror. So there's lots of parodies of how horror comics were written back in the day.
Well, and you see, especially in the first issue going into the second issue, his interest in Gothic, Victorian Gothic. And by Gothic, I don't mean, you know, The Cure or Sisters of Mercy. I mean, you know, yeah. Like
that's for next week.
One of my favorite names in this whole thing is Heathcliff Rochester.
Heathcliff Rochester. Okay, so should we just get into it?
Let's get into it, yeah.
Okay, so the first issue six, is, of course, The Secret of the Cellar Sinister, or The Secret House of Forbidden Cookies. Where we find Howard and Beverly. Howard is a duck, by the way. I don't know if you know that from his title. And Beverly is a human woman, and they have a relationship of sorts.
How does that work?
I don't know.
It's the George Lucas film from the 80s. Okay, let's not.
Yeah, no, we do not. We do not need that at all. Yeah, so they're on the road. They're hitchhiking in a storm, and they're trying to get home. And it looks like
it's some monstrous kind of duck. it's like right from the get-go, it's a joke. Anyway.
Right. Yeah. So, but it's set up like, I mean, looks like it's, you know, an EC comic, but it's not. It's just done for a gag. Beverly and Howard break up because Howard's, you know, a little stubborn, let's say. So they split up, and Beverly stumbles upon an old gothic mansion that looks like it's right out of Psycho, with a creepy kid and a crazy woman living in it. It's all stormy night and thunder right, cracks and
it's lightning and thunder, and it's rain, and it's the, and of course the, she's, oh, you're here for the governess position again, you've got your Victorian, this is so heavy on Victorian,
right, for Victorian or gothic horror, which he's playing with. I mean, it's set up to be to look like it's scary, but it's very far from that. Meanwhile, Howard wakes up to find a busload of
yuckies.
The Reverend June Moon Yuck and his yuckies, his devotees. And of course, this is, I don't know if anyone's familiar with Reverend Moon and the Moonies from back in the 70s. This was a religious cult, I guess you'd call it. The source of, how do you describe that?
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's, if people didn't experience Sun Young Moon, then some of this isn't going to make as much sense. But at this time, it was completely lacking in subtlety.
Right. Yes. This is Gerber just.
Because Sun Young Moon was very much part of the cultural zeitgeist at the time.
Right. So Sun Young Moon and then June Moon Yuck. Not being subtle, Mr. Howard or Mr. Gerber. But Howard is saved by your favorite character, which
Heathcliff
is
Rochester.
Heathcliff Rochester.
Who comes riding in on a horse, firing a gun, looking like, Heathcliff.
Yes, he's a highwayman, realtor, and lifestyle consultant.
And he comes riding in, and of course the language is the purple prose that Gerber does so well. But, it's like, turn back, ye provincial swine. They're being attacked by the townsfolk.
He is the owner of the Seven Gables Realty Corporation, an all-night key grinding service specializing in decaying Victorian mansions of pernicious repute.
I mean, it's a lot to pack in one panel.
It is.
It's literally just the panel of his business card that contains seven jokes.
And he prefers to use the term lifestyle consultant rather than realtor. Yeah, Heathcliff saves Howard, puts him on the back of his steed, and rides off to, as it turns out, the very mansion that Beverly is staying in, because he is the real estate consultant.
He's trying to sell the mansion because the town folk keep attacking the mansion because they think the little girl is a witch.
They think the little girl is a witch, and the mother's a little bit loony, as they say.
And they just killed the grandmother. They stoned the grandmother a week before.
Right. Yeah. So anyway, it's all set up a creepy horror hammer horror film. So Heathcliff and the dogs scare away the townsfolk, and Howard and Beverly are reunited, and it feels so good. Then we get just a series of strange jokes and just weirdness for the rest of the comic until we find out that the little girl, who is not a witch, but she's more like a Frankenstein.
She just wants to make cookies.
So we find out that she has actually made a sentient cookie. And it's done. It's the whole, 1930s Frankenstein.
Yeah, she's the whole
laboratory.
It's a lab. It's a laboratory with the coils and all of that stuff. And
yes. And she brings the cookie to life.
And it's not just any cookie. It's a giant gingerbread man cookie.
Yes. With yeasty fingers. With yeasty fingers. And he rose up angry. So that's a bizarre ending.
And of course we think, this is really setting up for the next couple issues, right?
Yes. Which is the reason I included, for the presidential run arc, we don't really need this issue. Except for the fact that in the next issue, it starts. Okay. So the next issue, From the Oven It Rises.
Yes, and that's, I love, that's on the cover, From the Oven It Rises.
The gingerbread cookie comes to life, and it's got ears that kind of look like bolts and a flat. It's total parody of Frankenstein.
Right.
This could be an entire issue, but the
giant fight scene, right? I mean,
yeah, it's the whole, yeah, exactly. It's going to be a whole,
terrorizes the village, and, that's what you expect.
But no, on literally page two, Howard dispenses with the with the cookie by chewing off its leg.
Well, it's a cookie.
I just want to read this out. After gluttonous moments later, surgery is completed. Just those words are said in a comic where Howard chews off the cookie's leg, who then falls into all the machinery and causes the house to explode. And that storyline's done.
Yep. within 2 pages.
Yep, within 2 pages. And Howard and Beverly walk off into the sunset or sunrise, and they start hitchhiking, which then gets to chapter 2, Get Down, America. And they are, and that's when Howard and Beverly are picked up in a limo by Dreyfus Gulch, the Rhinestone Cowboy. By the way, the song Rhinestone Cowboy was a huge hit at this particular time. So Dreyfus Gulch is going to be singing the national anthem at the third party, all-night party, the political party.
In New York.
In New York at Madison Square Garden. I mean, good for them. The all-night party has...
Yeah, how a third party managed to get the...
Yeah, Madison Square Garden. That's a pretty good deal. So Dreyfus Gulch brings them with them, gets them jobs at the convention. Howard is going to be a security guard, and Beverly is going to be a hostess girl.
Dreyfus Gulch has some ulterior motives when it comes to Beverly.
Yeah.
This is the 70s, right? This is when comics were still kind of geared towards kids.
Definitely geared towards kids.
This is one of the many instances of very adult humor. Like Dreyfus Gulch is, he's essentially like leering at Beverly's bosom and says something about, you know, the both of you. And he's not talking about Beverly and Howard.
Exactly. And the hostess girls at this are, the hospitality girls is what they're saying. Mm-hmm. And the hospitality they're talking about is not just bringing cookies and snacks. Yeah. So you were right. This is mid-70s, and Comics Code is still in effect.
Right.
I mean, it's been eased up.
I've said this about other comics like Secret Six, but how some of this stuff got by.
And again, I don't think that's why I brought that
and
up.
And more egregious things coming up.
Yeah. And I brought that up in my, that's why I brought up in my introduction that this period, there was no holds barred at Marvel. No one was, I don't think anyone was paying attention. You say, how did this get by? Lots of drugs and apathy, I believe.
There was a lot of Coke.
Yes. Yes. Coca-Cola.
Yes.
Yes. Now there was, creators were just sort of given free rein to do what they wanted. And this is Howard the Duck, which is a parody of Donald Duck, so much so that Disney eventually sued him. That's why he wears pants now, which is an interesting thing to say out loud. So anyway, yeah, so we have Howard working as a security guard.
Howard the Pig.
Howard the Pig, indeed.
That was a great line. Like Beverly refers to him as Howard the Pig.
And you go into, he goes into the security office, and one of the hospitality girls is sitting on a man's lap. And I just, wow. Now, I understand what, there's a lot of, how do we say it? There's a lot of rumor and innuendo around these conventions, what politicians got up to at this time. And Gerber's just not holding back. He's saying, oh yeah, this is what they do.
I do want to go back a little bit for the Howard the Pig thing, because that led to a very interesting discussion between Howard and Beverly, where she calls him out for power issues.
Right, because he does, once he puts the uniform on and has the baton, he starts thinking, you know, throwing his weight around. You swing your stick like it's natural.
Right. You know, and there's a discussion about like how a uniform changes a power dynamic. And that's inserted right in the middle of a humorous comic.
Right. Exactly. He says he's uncomfortable as an authority figure. And she says that's what they all say until they put on the uniform.
Right.
Damn. Again, I did read this comic. I was 7 at this time. I did read this comic at the time. None of this stuff made any sense to me.
Nope.
It was just a duck and he put on a cop's uniform and isn't that funny? So he kind of stumbles into a strategy meeting for the campaign. And it's just sort of a who's on first kind of a thing, you know, where they're just...
It's mocking political strategists. It's essentially like a whole scene of mocking political strategists.
It cannot condone assassinations unless in self-defense. We got to get the dumb people out of intelligence. They stumbles upon this meeting and Howard has some plain talk for them.
Right.
Just
common
tell the
sense. Howard is a common sense thinker.
Yeah. He just says, tell the truth. Tell people you don't know what you're doing, but as soon as you figure it out, everything's going to be fine. And they all, oh, we love him. We love him. Meanwhile, he keeps getting these, Howard, that is, keeps getting these messages with cryptic things like the ice cream's on the cake. Just thought you'd like to know. The pastry's in the oven. He has no idea what this is. So he does find out that there's going to be a bombing attempt which Howard figures out that it's in one of the Alaskan signs, the signs for Alaska, which he...
Because through a humorous bit of repartee, they get to Baked Alaska.
It's a very long setup to get to the punchline, Baked Alaska. But Howard does, he thwarts the plan of the bombing plan. So he then, because of his bravery and plain talk, he becomes the candidate for president. We want the duck, so saith the people.
And it should be noted that, I would vote for the all-night party myself.
Oh, absolutely. I would get down with the
whole. Who doesn't want an all-night party?
Exactly. And especially a 70s all-night party. You know that's got lots of shag carpeting. You know what I mean? Next issue, open season or the road to the White House is paved with shell casings.
Oh, are we skipping the Defender special?
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. I apologize.
I don't know how much it matters. Interlude.
Interlude. It's technically not part of the Howard the Duck. Well, it was a special collector's edition.
We don't have to do it.
No. Let's do it. Because it is funny. It's Howard the Duck joining the Avengers. Howard the Duck joining the Defenders.
Which
is written by Steve Gerber. So it's a crossover. And it's really funny that the cover is actually a parody of the first issue of The Defenders, except with Howard in the middle. A new group of supervillains has emerged on the scene, led by Dr. Angst, and then consisting of Sitting Bullseye, Tilly the Hun, the Black Hole, and the Spanker.
All of those characters are fantastic creations. I do want to, like, so one of the reasons this is germane, not only because they reference Howard running, but this is when we kind of first see the first germ of the assassination attempt.
Right.
And we get some history as to why it's happening that's not necessarily political either.
So Dr. Angst gathers these. First of all, the Black Hole has a cavity in his chest that swallows up people with the tagline, "The Black Hole Sucks." And everyone just sort of says, that's really disturbing. So anyway, Dr. Angst wants to infiltrate the Defenders.
Yeah, he wants to kill. Well, so it's a twofold plan, right? One is they need to assassinate Howard the Duck. The other one is he's trying to get to Doctor Strange to get more promethium.
Promethium, which is this wonder material.
It makes you, ostensibly makes you stronger, although we find out that may not be the case.
Exactly. Howard and Beverly stumble upon the Defender's mansion, where I guess it's Doctor Strange's mansion, where the Defenders are living.
It's Sanctum Sanctorium.
Exactly. Where they're greeted by Nighthawk, who is surprised by a talking duck, to which Howard retorts, "No offense, pal, but you're hardly one to criticize." And Beverly calls him the Falcon. All this stuff is really funny.
Yes.
So they go in, they meet the Defenders, and of course this, do they have a name, this group, or are they just Strange?
I don't think they're given a name. I mean, the whole point is like that they're mundane, like Z-list villains, and so Dr. Angst wants to bring them all together so that they can achieve somewhere outside of mundanity.
So they actually have to gaze into the pedestrian prognosticator, which is the doctor's shoe. They surround the Sanctum Sanctorum with a cereal box. So they're all trapped inside. By the way, none of this makes sense.
No.
A battle ensues where Doctor Strange is knocked unconscious and bestows upon Howard the mantle of Sorcerer Supreme, or gives him his temporary powers as the Sorcerer, right. The Mallard of the Mystic Arts. It's just a fun battle.
What it leads to is, so at some point Howard as the Sorcerer Supreme sends all of the combatants, both the Defenders and the group of villains, to Shea Stadium. Indeed. Which leads to the most absurd fight scene I think I've ever read. There are probably more absurd fight scenes that were written to be serious that didn't work out. But this one it's so silly. It's like Tilly the Hun is either she's telling the Hulk that she either beats him or if he beats her, he has to marry her. And then you have just the visual of the Spanker chasing after Beverly.
Yes. And he does. So the Spanker
battle.
This banker believes in corporal punishment and just carries a paddle with him and spanks people. He ends up spanking a police officer as well.
But all of the fight scenes, everything there is, Gerber, and who is the artist on this? Do you remember?
It's not Colin. It's not Colin.
They were having a field day. And like I said before, maybe there was a lot of coke involved.
Oh, it's Sal Buscema.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, Sal, yeah.
Yeah, they're having a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You can imagine Gerber submitting the script and the artist just going, okay, this is what we're talking about. This is the stuff. They basically get to do their typical Marvel fight scene, but with a humorous twist. And so then there's a magical battle going on between Dr. Angst and Howard, where they're doing, you know, variations on the Doctor Strange stuff, like the Broom of Wazoom.
Yeah. Which is, I believe, referred to as the most mundane of all.
The most banal spell of all.
Banal, yeah. There. and of course, at some point, the black hole self-sucks.
He does. Well, Beverly tries to stop him by holding his arm, which then gets stuck into his hand, stuck into his chest, and he self-sucks himself into non-existence. So eventually, through ingenuity, Howard uses Doctor Strange cape to wrap up Dr. Angst and knock him out. And the battle is won. Hooray! Dr. Strange comes back, puts everything to rights, brings the black hole back. And at one point, you see the cops crawling out of him.
Because at some point, like, he sucks some cops.
Yes, he sucks some
cops. This isn't my joke. This is Gerber's joke.
So this is just a silly comic, and it doesn't really have anything to do with the comic other than they put out a hit on Howard, which then gets picked up by other assassins.
Right. And we see the what turns out to be the antagonist, which has been hinted at before, but so we do get like a little bit of plot device.
And now we move on to the big one, Brian. This issue was I owned this issue at one point in my life, and it was big. It was talked about on the news as much as a comic could be in the mid 70s. But this was talked about as it hit popular culture kind of hard. You know, there were T-shirts, Howard for President, and little buttons that were sold. And Marvel took this and ran with it. And it's a very famous cover of the Daily Bugle with Howard bursting out of it with his fist in the air.
I think also, like, we have to remember this is only a few years after Nixon and Watergate. So this is when the country had started to, we could say we lost our innocence with Kennedy, Kennedy assassination, right? So, and then the 60s and all of that, but then Nixon, Watergate.
You could say we lost our innocence with Kennedy, we lost our soul with Nixon.
Right. And so, again, I was too young in 1976 to have a personal context for everything that was going on. But as someone who reads history and follows politics and various other pop culture, whatever, I mean, the country was in a mood.
It was definitely in a mood. So I was alive at this point. And again, I was seven. So I remember stuff, but I don't really remember it. You know, I wasn't aware of the politics at the time. Right. But again, like you, I know history. Mm-hmm. And the country was just, it was very discouraged with its politics and with the political parties. There was violence, horrible riots going on in the country. There were bombings going on in the country. A lot of it's funny how we don't really talk about that time.
Right.
You know, because there were domestic bombings happening.
The 70s were a weird stinking decade.
Yeah. When people
the 70s were weirder than the 60s.
70s were weirder than the 60s. Much weirder. And I always think of that. I think I've mentioned it on this show before, but it's a very transitional time of, you know, all this hope and changey stuff happening in the 60s and then the pushback in the 70s. And it just sort of clashed. It was just a mix. We were progressing, but going backwards at the same time. And that's reflected in the media at the time, in not just the news, but also in movies and novels. It's a very nihilistic time, while at the same time being groovy and disco and then punk. I mean, the 70s were weird.
Yeah.
it's really weird.
It's the perfect decade for Howard the Duck and Steve Gerber. And as we get into this next issue, which is kind of like, you know, the big one, Although When Bites the Beaver, besides being my favorite title of all time.
It is the favorite title of yours. We'll get into that. So the big one, Brian, as we said, Open Season, which is a very funny parody. He's a duck. It's a campaign season, but there's also people trying to assassinate Howard. So in fact, on the cover, it actually says, thought he was in season, claims the, or what does it say? Explains the prisoner. Carter yells foul. There's so many puns.
Yes.
So Howard is, there's a gunman who's trying to assassinate Howard, but that gunman is assassinated by another gunman who's also trying to kill Howard.
And that gunman ends up getting killed
by another gunman. Yeah. So there's a competition between gunmen of who's going to assassinate Howard.
And the concept is that because, so Howard tells the truth. Right. He is a he's a common sense truth teller. And this is a threat to the mysterious powers that be, meaning special interest groups or what have you.
Well, the oligarchy, because there's a bunch of rich businessmen who do not care for this at all.
Yeah. And it should be noted that Howard's not really that. His common sense is just generic. I hate the word common sense, the phrase common sense. It's a ridiculous phrase. And I think Gerber plays on that a little bit, which I really appreciate, because it's like what Howard's saying, it has no more substance than what anybody else is saying. But he's the common sense, tells the truth guy.
Yeah, he's a straight talking maverick.
Right, straight talking maverick.
So, yeah, I mean, so Howard goes into the campaign offices of the All Night Party, and you find campaign posters of him as a construction worker and him as a farmer and him as a priest. So they're trying to beef up his image, which he says is all hokum, and he hates this kind of thing because he's a straight-talking maverick, as we mentioned. So, and then you have a political campaign strategy meeting, and they're looking at how many assassination attempts were for all the candidates, and Howard is by far the highest, so he's rating really high, which is, in light of what happened yesterday, wow.
It's, we're getting into a weird real life imitating or art imitating type.
Yeah, I mean, this was written a long time ago, but right. It's still okay.
But yeah, so Howard, eventually they end up at the All Night Party headquarters, right?
Exactly.
This is what you're talking about. And of course, he has to meet the campaign manager, GQ Studley.
And a wonderful 70s, you know, shirt unbuttoned to his belly, basically. So they're trying to make over his, give him an image makeover, basically.
Right.
And they try to dress him in different clothes, and they are writing all these things that he should have, that he should say, which right. Howard is not taking any of this guff. So randomly finds another group that will help him out. And he, from the Yellow Pages, there used to be this book that had phone numbers in it.
What?
Yeah, that's how you had to look it up. And he randomly finds a group, Mad Genius and Associates, to help him with his image. And in comes several pages of political satire. He talks about if the military wants more weapons, then they have to give up their housing and live in caves. It sounds like all this practical stuff, but it's really just silly, like you were saying.
Right. It's like at some point, like he addresses the bus scene and he says, well, the parents should have to like...
The parents should be sent away in buses so the kids can hear their teachers.
If you want more money for the military, then you have to take away, yeah, like you said, the housing. So the military should just live in caves. It's again, it's all this, it's poking strongly at, I really hesitate to say this phrase, but it is poking at both sides.
It is. It is. Howard the Duck is both sizing it. Yeah, and he does mention many times the crazy conservatives and the jellyfish liberals.
Right.
But I honestly think this is very, very tongue-in-cheek, because not only is he poking fun at the political systems itself, but he's also poking fun at how the campaigns were covered.
How the campaigns were covered, and also how the process works in general. It's the cover. I mean, it's this issue is all like income. I mean, this is a really... Everything here is really sharp, and it's like razor thin sharpness on the satire. Gerber is taking on everything to do with the political process. And exactly. He's slicing and dicing it all over the place, using obviously Howard as the avatar for his own feelings. And it's fascinating because, again, it's like I said, it's like I can't remove Gerber from this issue.
No, this is Gerber. Not just, I think it's too simplistic to say he's just, voicing his opinions. Because he's a much more accomplished writer than just ranting.
Yeah.
But he is looking at this system, seeing its natural absurdities and pointing them out in a very blatant way. But he's talking about the absurdity of the process, the absurdity of how things are covered, the absurdity of the candidates themselves.
Yeah.
You know, say anything to get elected and then change your mind once you're in office. I mean, that it's cliche.
But it wasn't cliche in a mainstream comic at the time.
Especially a mainstream comic intended for children.
That stars a duck.
So this leads to his press conference. And I do just want to read something. You meat brains willingly subject yourselves to more abuse, physical and psychological, than any nation in history. You allow your eyes and lungs to be eaten away by pollution. You fill your digestive tracts with chemicals. Your ears are barraged by the sounds of jackhammer progress. All this while politicians and Madison Avenue bang away at your minds. You all want to be happy and secure, yet you open yourselves to the constant tension and pressure of a society that claims to be free, but refuses to let you make a move without first filling in forms in triplicate. And you wonder why you've got violence. You wonder why your young are dissident, empty-headed, and drugged into a stupor. It's because you fashioned an emotionally and intellectually sterile culture. If an individual is unwilling to spend his life plotting in pursuit of possessions, there's nothing for him to do. The United States is one big dateless Saturday night. Again, this is a kid's comic.
Yeah.
Now that, I believe, is Gerber having a little bit of a rant.
Yes.
And using Howard as his voice.
Very much so. And, yeah. And you know, I mean, it's...
That's someone who's angry.
It's relevant now.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe even more so.
Absolutely.
And our personal opinions are coming through here, I understand. But if you've been listening to us for any period of time, you already know some of our personal opinions.
The thing is, that's angry.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I don't want to both sides it here, but that could be either party saying that.
Right.
You know, it's just about who you blame at that point.
Right. And that's right. Therein lies the... So Howard is not blaming the fingers pointing at everybody as opposed
to,
like you said, if someone said that now, they would follow that up with blaming...
immigrants or...
someone else.
Yeah. Or someone, you know, whatever. But Howard in this particular situation is pointing directly at you, the reader, and saying, you're doing this, you're allowing this to happen. When we as a nation are allowing this to happen. But it's really fascinating that this was allowed. We talked about this already, but this is an entire page of basically text, the press conference page. And there's some funny jokes in here. I mean, that obviously, that little segment that I read out is one part of this whole page. And there's some funny stuff in here. This particular press conference puts him first in the polls so that Howard is probably going to be elected.
He is set up after this to basically...
yeah, to become the next president.
And then...
a scandal plucks the duck. Pictures are published in a newspaper, Daily Bugle, where he's in a pool. He's in a bubble bath with Beverly. Oh, Brian, such an innocent time when simply taking a bubble bath with someone would ruin your career.
Yeah.
Mm.
And of course, you know, I mean, this is the smear job. I mean, earlier on, you know, in this issue, like we think the big bads are because he meets with the special interest groups.
Who give him a lot of gifts. And when he says he's not going to spout what they have to say, they take all the gifts back.
They take the gifts back and threaten him, saying, you know, you've picked the wrong enemy. You know, we're going to ruin you. So the initial assumption is, like in the last couple pages here, when this image gets printed in the papers, we assume that it's these special interest groups who have united together to ruin him with bathing.
Yes, he's having a bubble bath. It's his girlfriend. Why is that a problem, Brian?
No, he is a duck.
Wouldn't he be floating on the bathtub? None of this is so unrealistic.
Right. Yeah. I mean, this comic sucks because there's no way this duck would. Okay. Anyway.
Yeah.
You know, it's like this is comic book fanboys, you know, looking at Howard the Duck and being like, well, actually,
a duck would not be able to wear a suit and tie like that.
Yeah. So you know, the comic ends with like, oh no's.
Pollster say he's finished.
So, it's like, okay, well, let's get to the next issue to see what actually happens. Just like in the Gingerbread Man issue, we're like, oh man, the next issue is going to be all about the fallout from that, right?
Well, it is for a page.
It is for a page.
Yeah. So their whole campaign is taken down. It cuts to a splash page of banners on the floor.
It is over. Well, we're like after the day after the election.
Yep. And stay after election, and he lost.
Boom, he's done. Okay, end of story. But wait.
But wait, it's a conspiracy because that photo was traced to a foreign power. It's a conspiracy, Brian.
The most nefarious foreign power we could possibly imagine.
It's Canada. So we find out afterwards that Howard has to find out who framed him. So he commandeers a plane.
The all-night party sends him because they have to save their face. Dreyfus Gulch is still around. I don't know what he's hoping to accomplish at this point.
They send him on a night flight, the fly-by-night airways, to...
Oh, shit, you recorded that too.
I did. We got ourselves an outro. So anyway, we find out that the airplane doesn't have a pilot, so Howard has to land a plane. But a very earnest Mountie sees them.
Yes, I love the Mountie. What's the name of the Mountie, Paul? Sergeant Preston Dudley. Okay, this is right back to Heathcliff Rochester. Listeners will know why these two names amuse me so much, but I'm not going to go into it.
You could say that Gerber do right.
Yeah.
So the plane crashes, but they're fine. Don't worry. And the Mountie picks them up. The Mountie and his trusty husky, Elizabeth. I don't know why that makes me happy that there's a husky named Elizabeth. But it is.
And his horse.
Prince.
And I have a quote that I specifically took time to write down. So when they're putting Beverly and Howard on the horse, Sergeant Preston Dudley, RCMP, says, "He appreciates a lovely lady on his back as much as I do." I took the time to write that down.
So did Gerber.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there's a lot of innuendo. This could be an episode of Are You Being Served? There's so much sexual innuendo.
Had to pet my pussy last night. And the two people who have ever watched Are You Being Served will know exactly what I did there.
Okay, so Howard and Beverly tell Preston Dudley what's going on. And he has an idea of who possibly could have done this. Now, how do you say his name? Pierre Dentaris? Canada's only super patriot?
Dentifrice.
Dentifrice. So Pierre Dentifrice, Canada's only super patriot. Sacre bleu, Preston Dudley of the Mounties, he says. There's lots of the French accent in this comic.
Oh, yeah. coming up, we're skating on some.
Well, it has a very Monty Python-esque kind of thing, because he calls Howard an American gnat. It's an American gnat, ducky. It turns out that Pierre, Canada's only super patriot, really wants to annex the United States. So his plan is to cause so much political turmoil that America will be weak and Canada can invade and annex the United States.
And part of his plot, of course, you know, we haven't even mentioned the bellboy. You know, the bellboy is the running gag through all of this.
Yes.
Part of his plot at some point was to drop like thousands of beavers.
Yes, beaver bombs, basically.
Beaver bombs around Niagara Falls to build a dam.
Yeah, to build a dam and cut off
the U.S. from Canada at the Niagara Falls. And of course, so they succeed. But the U.S. then sends a bunch of fighter planes to destroy the beaver dams, which led to Pierre to age 78 years in a couple months.
Yes, he does indeed. And then, of course...
Well, the bellboy, remember, we've been seeing the bellboy throughout all this. The bellboy is the one behind all the assassinations attempts.
Right, yes.
Well, Pierre is behind it, but then he sent the bellboy to do it. So all of these assassination attempts that have been happening in the smear job with the pictures of the in the tub, all of this is this bellboy who hates ducks because
yes.
A duck killed his brother in Vietnam because... The duck got hit by a plane and fell on a mine that was near where his brother was and blew up his brother.
So he hates ducks and he wants to kill the feathered fiend.
Right.
Yes.
So he was easily manipulated by Pierre, who is also known as the Beaver.
So the bellboy is thwarted by Elizabeth the Husky. But as this is happening, Beverly is kidnapped by beavers. So Howard has to use his tracking skills, which leads him straight to Niagara Falls, where he finds Pierre dressed in a beaver suit. It's very Hannibal, if Hannibal Lecter dressed in a beaver suit.
And here's where you get that like silly, like French, English, patois. This fight scene is awesome because it's not a fight scene.
No, not at all.
The beaver, right, has...
I am Le Beaver. We must fight to Le Mort.
has extended a rope across Niagara Falls, and he wants to fight Howard. So he comes out to the middle of the rope over right. Niagara Falls, right? And so the fight scene is basically like Howard saying, nah, I'm not going to do this. He walks off, thereby making slack in the rope.
Which causes the beaver to fall.
That's the fight scene. That's the climax. Howard is saying, and Steve Gerber is still saying, this is ridiculous. I'm not fighting a man dressed as a beaver on a rope over Niagara Falls. So he just walks off.
And he gives a kind of an epilogue to this whole political storyline where he leaves the fight. As far as I'm concerned, he says, you and your politics can go jump. Meaning, I'm done with this right now.
Right.
And all he did was step off the rope. And everyone says, oh, you were brilliant. You were great. We all saw it. You're a hero. And he says, meh, I guess this basket case is closed. That's it. That is the run. That is the presidential run of Howard the Duck. It is silly and it is filled with jokes and one-liners that we can't even, and references to things current at the time, plus old stuff like movies from the 40s and 50s, you know, stuff that Gerber would have grown up with.
It's still accessible.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think like comic book fans, like, you know, maybe not new comic book fans, but comic book fans, we're a weird bunch. We just are. We're weird. I embrace that. But we would still get, we still get the references, even though it's separated by, my God, 50 years? How long ago is this? This is 50 years. This is 50-year-old comic. Almost 50-year-old.
Almost 50-year, yeah, so.
Almost a 50-year-old comic, like 45 to 50-year-old comic. That's a long time.
That is a very long time.
And nothing's changed.
If anything, it's gotten worse. So a lot of the satire in this that he brings up against, you know, the news media and the political parties and how campaigns are being run, it's more prominent now than it was back then, which is a sad state of affairs.
I did not think about how long ago this was till just now. So if I sound incredulous as I'm saying...
Well, doesn't it sound like it was just a
week ago?
Yeah, just like, because I remember this. I remember, like I said in the intro, I remember reading this comic on my living room floor. It doesn't seem that long ago, but then again, I'm old. Anyway.
We're young at heart, just like Howard the Duck.
Absolutely. But yeah, I mean, Howard the Duck as a concept in comic, even more so than things like Man-Thing or The Defenders or any of the other stuff that Gerber wrote. This really kind of embodies his thought, his style, his humor. If you want Gerber being straight up Gerber, read Howard the Duck. It's his baby. It's Gerber's baby.
It is indeed.
So, yeah. So, I mean, this was, like I said, it was important at the time because it did cause quite a stir when it was first published.
It ruffled feathers.
It paid the bill. We'll get rid of that one.
It went along swimmingly, though.
Yes. It was a touchdown.
It was either one thing or the other.
Yes. So that was the presidential arc of Howard the Duck. But before we go, I do, Brian, I would like to get your thoughts on one particular issue, which is now famous and infamous, as per our credo. So it is issue number 16. And little backstory, Steve Gerber was having a hard time meeting deadlines. He had several comics going on, and he missed an issue of Howard the Duck. But instead of just missing the deadline, he submitted an essay, which artists then put some pictures to. This essay is called Zen and the Art of Comic Book Writing, a communique from Colorado. So what this is, again, I will state up front, I find this absolutely fascinating. And the fact that, again, he was able to do this is an amazing thing to me. Mm-hmm. We can discuss its merits down the road. But what he did was Steve Gerber, in real life, was in Colorado, making a road trip from Colorado to Las Vegas and eventually the Grand Canyon. Mm-hmm. Along the way, he wrote a dialogue with himself and Howard the Duck. Basically, he, Steve Gerber, was giving the reasons why he was going to miss the issue. And he had Howard fighting him, saying, just get over yourself. And he explains his reasoning of how he's feeling and mm-hmm. why it's taking him so long, and how he's basically, it is a creator. We see this all the time. Like YouTubers now do it all the time, where it's creative burnout. Yeah. You feel like you've lost your ideas. You feel like a fraud. It's a, you know, imposter syndrome.
Right.
And he talks very straightforwardly about how he doesn't know if he can continue. He doesn't know where his next idea is going to come from. Is he any good? But then at the same time, talking about how you need time to just take, you know, to not be pressured all the time and to have something. And it culminates in him critiquing his own work. What are your first impressions of this?
Well, some of this is akin to Grant Morrison's famous Animal Man comic many years later, where he literally broke the fourth wall,
yes.
demolished it, you know, and it's where Buddy Baker is like, I can see you talking to the reader. And other creators have used that since then, but I think that particular moment was unique to comics at the time and kind of a brave thing to do. And so going back a decade plus to Howard the Duck, when it's Steve Gerber arguing with himself.
Exactly.
With Howard the Duck being his internal monologue, or his
alter ego, as we kind of
his discussed. Devil or angel on his shoulder, what have you. We obviously hadn't seen anything like that, at least in mainstream comics. I don't want to present myself as a historian who would know if in other comics that had existed in this way before this. I think this is a really difficult comic. I understand what he's doing, and I think it is very much unique. There is an aspect to it where he is bringing the reader into dialogue that doesn't necessarily have to belong in comics medium, and it's a longer discussion than I think we have time or energy for, in terms of, because comics are very separate in many ways from like literature, or like meaning like books, or you know, art. It encapsulates all of these. This is why I think comics is a very unique medium, because it encapsulates several different art forms into a thing that other mediums don't do necessarily. I'm trying to be cautious in how I approach this.
Well, I could say that, you know, I understand what you're getting to. At the same time, a creative mind is, regardless of the medium, you're still going through the same issues, the same problems.
Yes.
Yeah. And this is a creator, a writer. I do this too, where you just get so lost and you know, you're cranking things out. You're working really hard. And then suddenly I don't know what I'm doing anymore. And sometimes, you know, a little bit of just self-dialogues, a little bit of, you know, therapy to yourself. That's what this feels like to me. This is Steve Gerber getting his thoughts, all these things that he can't articulate, and he tries to articulate them in a kind of a platonic dialogue with Howard the Duck.
I think if this were now, this would be a Substack post, or this would be a Facebook post, or this would be a Twitter post, or pick your poison internet wise.
Right.
That option was not available.
And I say kudos to Marvel. I mean, yes, there was some, we talked about the chaos going on behind the scenes, but someone did say, yes, okay, we're going to publish this.
And someone said, okay, well, let's get some artists and some really fine artists.
Oh yeah. A lot of good people on here
to contribute to this piece. But this isn't, so for me, it's like, this isn't an indie comic in the way we think of indie comics now, which are very self-reflective and very autobiographical. This was a comic that thousands or more people were going to their newsstand to pick up. And what they got was an autobiographical screed with a considerable amount of self-loathing, but also a considerable amount of reflection. And
this is obviously a guy going through some stuff.
Yeah. I don't know if at the time this comic would have been remotely appealing to me, partly because, you know, if I want to read a book, I get a book. If I want to read a comic, I get a comic, you know, and he addresses that. He addresses a lot of this stuff. Don't get me wrong. I think it's fascinating.
Yes.
I think the whole thing is fascinating. But at the same time, it was slightly tedious to get through because partly the purple prose that Gerber uses and various other things, it was, part of me was like, man, I don't want to read through all this. I don't want to read through like some guy like losing his mind.
See, I can tell you straight up that I remember this issue on the newsstand, which I did not get as a kid. Because I looked through it and as a kid said, I don't like this.
That's a lot of words.
This doesn't look appealing to me. I mean, it had Man-Thing in it, so that's kind of cool. But other than that, but as an adult, and I've read this several times, and I find it, what you said, I find it fascinating. I find it very brave as far as just doing this and then putting it out there in the world, putting it out there in a mainstream comic book that he knows. And he addresses, like you said, he addresses it in the prose where he says, you're going to hate me for this. And there were, and this was very divisive when it came out. There were people who thought it was a masterpiece. And there were people who thought this is bullshit. You know, this is self-indulgent. And I'm going to say for the record, it's both. It's a masterpiece of self-indulgent bullshit. And I find it incredibly fascinating. I find it, especially for the time. So this would have been 77, I guess, 77, 78, when this came out, to put this out in a mainstream comic from Marvel, where he knew that he was not going to be embraced for this,
right,
was very brave. And he still did it anyway. And he had a lot of artists who said, yeah, man, let's do this, which I find, you know, that's just incredible to me.
Right.
And there's so much in this. And I know what you were saying. It is very self-indulgent, as I said, but there's a lot of insight too. He's getting to some deep shit in his creative process.
And there are lots of fascinating bits about the creative process, including like how comics are created.
Right.
You know, he talks about at one point, you know, he tells Howard that communicating is hard. You know, I mean, there are very interesting aspects to it. I love the fact that in the obligatory fight scene, he lays out the script or the plot points of his 1998 Vertigo comic, Nevada, about the ostrich and the showgirl. And it's like, okay, like I'm looking at that going, oh my God, 20 years later, he actually wrote that comic. That's really interesting to me that he had that story in his mind 20 years before he actually got around to writing it and published by Vertigo.
That's an interesting aspect right there, where you say, was he just trying to make up an absurd, you know, in order to prove a point, he makes up this absurd situation. And then 20 years later, he says, you know what? That's actually pretty good. I could write that. I can do that now. Yeah, but there's a point where it's part one, part two. Part one is writers are like people.
But writers are plants and plants are people and people are writers or whatever.
Yeah. It is. Well, you got to get yourself rooted into a spot. Yeah. And sometimes the roots don't take hold. And sometimes they take too much of a hold. And, you know, yeah,
for all that just to be like, well, I'm just spaghetti.
Right. But then the part two is term left a fork in the tongue. I love the image is of him trying to make a decision of what road to go down. And he has the choice of doom or despair. Despair is missing a deadline, continuing on with his life. And then doom is not doing that, which, by the way, has a picture of Dr. Doom along that path. But yeah, I mean, he's talking about his basically writer's block. He doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know if he's doing the right thing. He's questioning his life decisions. But then he has his alter ego of Howard saying, get over yourself. You've got a good life. This is just a blip in the road and you're going to get past it. And then he has the obligatory fight scene, which is wonderful. And then at the end, he has, and then, well, at the end of his dialogue, they end up at the Grand Canyon, which is the biggest rut in the world, nature's yes. rut. Yeah, and I love the fact that nature has time to create something beautiful. I'm forced to do it every month. And it's like, I get, you could feel the pressure that he's under and yeah. not wanting to fail. And I get that completely.
Yeah. And I don't think any of his ideas are problematic. Like it's the ideas that he's pushing out there are interesting, and it's an interesting read into a creative mind.
Then he does something interesting where he writes an actual story. I'm using quotes, a story about a man who has too much paperwork and
too much pressure, and he runs away.
And he runs away, and his wife isn't paying attention to him. So he writes this thing, and then comes the fascinating part, is the very next page has him in class with Howard as the professor deconstructing the story he just wrote.
As you can guess, that's my favorite part as a deconstructionist. And for our readers, you know, it's Paul and I have had numerous discussions on different types of literary theory. I'm a deconstructionist, which is out of favor these days. Paul is not.
Well,
fan of deconstruction. Is that a safe way to say that?
It's not something I gravitate towards. I don't dislike it as a legitimate form of critique. It's not my favorite. It's something that you gravitate toward, and that's fine.
But the humor of it all for me was like reading that, going, "Hey, this is Paul, one of Paul's very favorite writers, who is now delving into deconstruction," and so that amused me.
Yes, yes. A little bit of deconstruction is nice. If you go too far, then you're just like, okay, you're going too far. But anyway, no, but I love the fact that he writes this story. So, you know, the way to get out of writer's block or a rut is to just write something and not right. have to worry about it. He then takes it upon himself to look at what he just wrote and deconstructs it like he's at a classroom and pulls out all his own themes so mm-hmm. that he knows I can use this later.
And of course, then it ends with, you know, the U.S. Army, like, lining up outside and trying to, like, kill Howard the Duck again.
And again, this is, if you want to get deconstruction about it, this is, you know, he knows the critics are going to take aim. Mm-hmm. And they're going to shoot him.
He's inserting himself.
They're going to shoot him down. But what happens is they missed and mm-hmm. Howard still lives. So he still gets to move on.
He's patting himself on the back a little bit, saying he allowing himself to dodge the criticism.
At the same time, you get the next page where it has a bunch of outraged, angry fans, Marvelites, putting him through a meat grinder and churning out Gerber-strained brains.
But that page is him writing to himself. And that's one of the ones that I disliked the most, was him writing to himself as a, you know, it's him writing as an angry. So it's
a fan letter.
And it's signed by, it's a fan letter, right? So it's the page where you would have the, you know, letters to the editor or whatever. And I think he deflects at that point. He decides that he is going to take on the voice of the fans. And even though we know that he is a fan,
okay,
but the idea that he decided that he gets to be the voice of the fan.
See, I don't.
It feels really presumptuous. And so he's using try to deflect the criticism.
I don't read it that way.
And yet, sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry to cut you off. I don't read it that way at all. I see the fan letter as he's not taking on the voice of the fans. He's saying, "Steve, I'm a fan of you." It's like he is a fan of himself. And he goes, and if you read that fan letter, he says that, you know, there are certain things that are, I don't really like these certain things, but this is pretty good. And, you know, he said, "Oh, the obligatory fight scene, that was pretty cool."
But he's deciding what he addresses and what he doesn't get to address.
I think he's talking to himself. I think he's saying, it's okay. You know what? You're not Tom, like he says, you're not Tom Robbins. You're not Thomas Pynchon, but that's right. Okay. It's all right. Just be who you are. It's basically saying he's in deep depression right now, and he's sort of giving himself a pep talk. See, right. I don't think he's trying to be presumptive and take on the voice of the fans. I think he's trying to say, it's okay. Your failures are not as bad as you think they are, and your successes are better. It's very internal.
Yeah, but he used it as a fan letter.
I just think he was using the, you know, this is a comic book, and they always end with, letters, a letters page.
Right. So. Letters. We've got letters.
That's right.
Lots and lots of letters.
But then he also says at the end, like, get back to the Dr. Bong stuff.
Right. So, I mean, I appreciate what you're saying and I understand, but the medium, the choice of medium, and I guess some of the emo, and again, this goes, like, there are plenty of writers and artists now in comics who are working through issues. Again, I referenced Grant Morrison earlier. Grant Morrison had a long run of from Animal Man through The Filth where he was dealing with the death of his cat. And that theme ran through a good decade or more of Grant Morrison's writings. And we see that. But he was able to do it, like we look back now and read into it and understand that that's what Grant Morrison was going through. But he didn't make it, like, obviously about himself in the same way that I think Gerber did. And that's not fair. I'm not trying to compare the two writers. They're vastly different writers in vastly different ways.
Well, they each dealt with their own, I don't know what I call it, their own problems, their own issues. They each dealt with their own issues in their own way. And I think for me, you know, like I said, when I first read this, didn't like it. It took me many, many years. It's only, you know, within the last decade of me rereading this that I thought, wow, you know, this guy, he was having, and it's not unique to Steve Gerber. I think everyone who has to be creative on a deadline constantly will go through this kind of burnout, will go through this form of self-loathing and like I said, imposter syndrome and feeling that you're just faking it. Everyone goes through this. And this was him kind of working through his mind, all getting all that out, getting all of those things onto paper. And then at the end saying, it's okay. You're going through this. You'll get past it. Steve still likes you. I'll see you next month. And he does. He goes, right. He gets back in and writes another, you know, 10 issues of Howard the Duck before it's canceled. So.
And I'm not saying that these aren't important things, but forcing isn't the right word. Nobody is forced to do anything when it comes to purchasing entertainment. But in some ways, a little bit, because again, people were buying this comic because they follow Howard the Duck and they don't know what's inside because they didn't have a preview on Bleeding Cool. You know what I mean? And so, you know, someone goes to their comic book shop and they pick up their stacks of comics for the days and they paid 60 cents, 50 cents, whatever it is. And they get home and they sort out their stack of comics like we all do. And we're like, I'm going to read this first and I'm going to read these in this order. And he kind of forced a lot of people into his personal journey that maybe isn't fair. When I pick up a new copy of James Joyce's Ulysses, I know what I'm getting into. And I know, like, the vast majority of people in the world just have no interest in that. And it's not a book that they want. But when I go to buy a new copy because my old copy is all marked up, I get that copy because I know what's inside. Or I have a sense of what's inside and I have committed to the journey that comes from that. When I buy a comic now, I'm making a choice of, I kind of have a sense of the subject matter. I kind of have, again, because of the elevated nature of the internet and information and whatever. If I'm buying something blind as a guess, that's different than buying something not blind and being blindsided.
Okay, well, from another...
Does that make sense?
It does. I disagree with it. I do, because, like I said, I remember this comic coming out at the time, and I did not buy it at the time, because 25 cents was a precious commodity to me.
Yes.
However, I really like this, and I'm glad this exists. Mm-hmm. I'm glad it happened. It gives insight not only to one of my favorite writers, but the creative process in general. And combining that with the process of writing a comic book, which is also one of my favorite mediums. And then you combine the fact that he wrote most of this in Georgetown, Colorado, which I have been to multiple times.
Yeah, he's 35 miles out of Denver. We both lived in Denver.
And I've been to Georgetown. I've sat in little
Denver proper.
He talks about sitting in cafes. It's not the same one. I'm sure that's not there anymore. But anyway, I read this with absolute fascination and I admire it. And I think this is great, me personally. And it was everything you said was how people felt at the time.
Right.
How dare you inflict this upon us? At the same time, looking back on it historically, this was really great, especially when you know the backstory of everything that was happening behind the scenes at Marvel. Knowing this and seeing this, I find it insightful and glad it exists. I think it's great. And I understand why you wouldn't. And someone as an adult, someone who has been attempting to be a writer for a long time now, to read this and say, yeah, he's going through the same shit that I'm going through. It's nice.
Well, and that's probably the great part about this is that you could get two very different reactions from it, which is maybe what you want.
Exactly. And we know Mr. Gerber, after this was done, did get out of his rut and cranked out some more comics for decades to come.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, that was it. I mean, anyone who's listening, who's interested, issue 16 of Howard the Duck, just check it out. Maybe you'll be like Brian and not like it, or maybe you'll be like me and you will like it. But it's definitely, hey, if nothing else, it is a very interesting and unique thing that happened.
It's a conversation starter.
For sure. So that's it. That was Howard the Duck. Anything more to say on the duck?
How are you doing? I've been waiting weeks for that.
I'm glad you got a chance to do it. Next time, it's going to be me again.
It's you again because I'm slacking.
I am here to pick up the slack. I'm a slack picker. So next time on an all-new edition of the Collected Edition, we will be reading a little emo gothy classic, The Crow by James O'Barr from 1989.
Okay.
The original four issues, which just to give you an insight into what this is all about, the issues are called Pain, Fear, Irony, Despair.
Ooh, this is going to be fun.
Hey now, sing this corrosion to me. So we're going to read The Crow from 1989. Thanks, everybody, for listening.
Thanks again for stopping by.
Yeah, thanks for bearing with us during our half a year hiatus. it's good to be back. I love talking to you, Brian. I'm so happy to be doing this again.
Yeah, it is very good to be back.
Yeah, we're going to try to just start cranking these out on a regular basis again. So you can all hear our lovely voices and insightful comments.
Since I won't listen to my own voice.
I know, you've never listened to it. I'm actually, so everybody.
I've never listened to an episode of our podcast.
In contrast, I have listened to our episodes so many times. I'm so sick of my voice. Not yours. I'm sick of my voice.
Well, you're the Archie Goodwin of the Collected Edition. You're the editor in chief.
Well, thank you very much. I've never been called the Archie Goodwin of anything, but that's quite the compliment. And in case anyone's interested, I have, in our hiatus, I have redesigned the website because it's what I do. And I'm going to be putting up articles. I'm going to attempt anyway to start doing some reviews of number ones that come out every week. Nothing too deep dive, just kind of talk about what's coming out. Well, I will do that until I forget, which is a possibility. But until next time, from me to you, I can't get how to end.
Understand it.
Yes. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And until next time, keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the program are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. If you'd like to give us your feedback, the show can be found online at our website, collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes, or send us an email to comments at collectededitionpodcast.com. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.